Well, I am excited to be here with you all today. But I gotta confess, this is a busy time of year, isn't it? How many of you have Thanksgiving all ready to go? How many of you are like me and still have not purchased that turkey? Yeah, those are my people. I have not yet. I'm hosting with my kids are coming into town, and there is no food in my house, so I'm not sure what exactly we are going to do for Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is busy. Christmas is also coming, making us busy there too. And let me tell you, hockey season, right? That is a busy, busy time that I didn't really realize I was getting into, but it's so busy. And then I've heard from some families how their spouses are all super busy right now, sitting in the woods and waiting for animals. So I don't understand quite what that's about yet, but it is a busy time of year. I find myself feeling like I am juggling a million things. Let me know, have you ever felt in your life that you just can't keep up with all the things that are going on? Yeah, I find myself just running from one activity to the next thing, to the next thing. This is an actual screenshot of my calendar for the last month. Oh, yeah, hockey, right? No, the 15th was a lovely day. I only had two things really going on that day. It's a busy, busy time of year. And as I've gotten to know all of you over these past couple of months, I think it's really busy for you all too. Maybe it's juggling kids and home and work like I do. And maybe for some of you, it's juggling doctor's appointments and difficult health decisions. And maybe it's juggling expectations from other people. You feel like you have to please them. Maybe it's juggling addiction and depression and just trying to function regularly with those things going on. Maybe it's just trying to juggle holiday schedules with families and in-laws and children and blended families and who gets time with who and who can I upset the least, right? Well, this morning, we are going to test your juggling skills. This is going to be fun. Okay, all right, we are going to take an awareness test. Are you ready, Pam? Pay attention, folks. Oh, how many passes does the team in white make? Ready? Start counting. Can you turn on the volume for this, Pam? What'd you get?
The answer is 13.
13, yeah.
But did you see the moonwalking bear?
Did you see the moonwalking bear? Who's, anyone? Anyone see the moonwalking bear? Wait for it. Ready? Oh. It's easy to miss something you're not looking for. All right, honestly, who missed the moonwalking bear the first time around? Yeah, if you didn't see it, I'll totally show it to you later. We'll come back, we'll have a hole, I'll show you the moonwalking bear. It was there the first time around, I promise, right? This is just kind of a cool commercial that I found for looking for a cyclist while you're driving, right? But I think it's a good example for us this morning because I think that we focus on all of these things swirling around us. And we miss this pretty cool moonwalking bear that's been right in the middle of the commercial. And so their tagline is, say it with me, it's easy to miss something you're not looking for. And that's what we're going to talk about this morning. You see, we're in our final week of our Stories Matter series, and we've been looking at how stories shape the way we see the world and how they form how we're looking at our life experiences, how they sculpt the lens in which we view the world. And I think we often miss what God is doing in our stories because it's easy to miss something you're not looking for. 10 years ago, I had the chance of a lifetime to visit Alaska with my whole family. It was very, very cool. My mom and dad took us on this trip. And one day, we took an 8-hour school bus ride. Imagine that, first of all. An 8-hour school bus ride. And at that time, I had 3 children, for this 8-hour school bus ride to go see wildlife in Denali National Park, and so that we could get as close to Mount McKinley as possible without having to go backpacking or hire a plane to get there. And it was also during this period of my life when I was trying to decide if I was going to stay working at the church that I was serving or if I was going to have my fourth child that we wanted. I knew that at that time my schedule was too busy and that my work was too much because I found myself getting sick all the time, just picking up a cold here or picking up a sinus infection there because I wasn't getting enough sleep. I just had too much going on working full time and having life with three kids. And so after these 8 hours into the park, we got off the bus at our destination. And I found myself sitting there next to this Alaskan lake, worrying about whether or not I should quit my job with the people I loved or stay home with my kids, and whether or not that would be enough for me. And I sat to this lake, and I was consumed with these worries, these thoughts swirling around me like basketballs all around a moonwalking bear, until my oldest son splashed me with ice-cold Alaskan water. And that's the moment I realized that I was missing it, that I was there, but not really there with my children in one of the most beautiful places on earth with the people I loved the most, because my thoughts were still over here, and because of that, I was missing the experience. Another time, I remember hosting a dinner where I had invited some people over that I wanted to impress. And so I became so consumed with making sure that everything was just right, that the table was set right, that the food timing was perfect as it came out of the oven, that people were having a good time, that their drinks were filled, and that they were laughing. And guess what? I missed most of the dinner because I was running around. And some of you, yeah, you're like, I've spent every Thanksgiving in the kitchen for 30 years. I get it, right? Yeah, we miss what we're not looking for. And I think we all in this room, we want to focus on things like our relationship with God and our families and our personal joy. But I think as Americans, we are told and sold a very different story, another competing story that tries to make its way in. When I was in junior high, all I wanted in the whole world were Guess jeans. Yeah, you guys remember, right? Trendy, expensive jeans with this cool triangle sewn on the back pocket. And if you had the triangle on your back pocket, it indicated that you were cool, that you were in the in crowd. And I was thoroughly convinced that if I had a pair of these Guess jeans, that I would be accepted and make friends in junior high. You see, there was this group of girls at my school that had so many pairs of these jeans, and they made fun of my knockoff Palmetto brand jeans. And I was new to the school, so I desperately wanted to be enough and wanted to be part of a group of friends. But even more than that, I wanted to just not be made fun of. So I proceeded to do what any self-respecting 12-year-old would do. I babysat, and I saved my money so that I could buy myself these jeans. Now, in the 80s, these jeans were about $60, and I got paid $2 an hour to babysat. I know I'm aging myself, right? So you can do the math and see how many hours of watching other people's children I did in order to get this pair of jeans. And it was a lot of work, but I can remember going to buy that pair of jeans and how I tried them on in their acid-washed goodness, and I just knew I was going to be accepted. I just knew that I was going to be included when I walked around the dressing room in my fancy new Guess jeans. I just knew that I was going to be enough. And the next day was glorious. I walked into middle school a little prouder, strutting with my acid-washed triangle pocket pride, and no one made fun of me that day. So I got home, and I quickly threw my jeans in the wash so that I could wear them again the next day. I picked out a new t-shirt and expected that the second day in my new jeans would be just as equally glorious as the first. But then a girl came up to me at lunch and said, "Wait, Angie, do you just have one pair of Guess jeans? And you went home and washed them?" And I just didn't know what to say. So I snuck into the bathroom and I cried, disgusted that these jeans did not do what they had promised me, that they didn't earn me acceptance like I thought that they would, that I had totally bought into this idea that this thing, this pair of jeans, would somehow change the direction of my life. I had totally bought into the thought that they would fill up something in me that I felt was missing. And I think we all do this. Studies show today that a young girl's self-esteem peaks at age 9. Yeah, and a young boy at age 11. 9 and what is that? Right? I think we should be entirely outraged at that. And as I have raised children, I kind of believe that statistic. I watch what these 3,000 images my children are exposed to a day, what it does to them. Trying to sit there and say, hey, come over here. Let me show you how to be cool. Come over here. Let me define you. Come over here. Let me show you what success looks like. Come over here. Let me show you what's going to make you work worthwhile. All of these tossing basketballs passed around them, and they don't know where to keep count. And I think if we're honest as adults, this is the case for us too. All of these things flying around us, lobbying for our attention, pulling us away from the Mount McKinleys that are right in front of us or from the people at our dinner table. My friend cried to me recently, telling me about how stressed she was and how burnt out on life she was, struggling with her boss at work, her daughter, teenage daughter, wrestling with her body image, her mom struggling with an illness, increasingly distant between her and her husband, wondering how they were going to afford what their kids really, really wanted for Christmas this year. She told me about how she was worrying about her weight and how aging was taking its toll on her 40-something body. And I think this happens to all of us in some way. These flying basketballs competing to tell us what life should look like, what we should be striving for. And all the while, we are missing the great joy that is there the whole time. Right there, we are missing God and our family right in the midst of it. We don't even notice. And in the Bible, in John chapter 4, we're going to look at another woman's story today. And I think it'll show you how universal this experience really is. And you can follow along with me in your bulletins or on your screens. Now Jesus, that's what he is, Jesus. Jesus had to go through Samaria, and Jacob's well was there. And Jesus, he was tired from his journey, so he sat down by the well, and it was about noon. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. We're going to pause here for a second. Let's set the stage. Here, Jesus is at a well, and he is tired and thirsty and vulnerable, and he's in Samaria. Samaria is a foreign place, and it's one that doesn't like his people, the Jewish people. And Jesus, he is all alone. His disciples have went to buy some food and left him there without a water bottle. So he sits down by a well, but he has no bucket to get himself some water. So then a Samaritan woman comes to the well, and he quickly asks her, "Give me a drink." Now this, my friends, is scandalous in biblical times for a number of reasons. First of all, this woman is showing up at the well at noon. Usually the gathering of water in a country like this would have been in the morning or in the evening, but not in the heat of the day. The gathering of water would have been a social time for all the women to go together, but she is obviously avoiding the other women. The Samaritan woman is choosing to be alone, and this is a key part of the story because she doesn't want to be with the other women in her community. All right, we'll keep going. Now the Samaritan woman said to Jesus, "For you are a Jew and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." And Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you," say it with me, "living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw with and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water?" And Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I will give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life. The woman said to him, Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water. And Jesus told her, Well, go call your husband and come back. I have no husband, she replied. And Jesus said to her, Well, you are right to say that you have no husband. The fact is that you have had five husbands, and the man you have now is not your husband. What you have said is quite true. Astonished, the woman said, I know the Messiah called Christ is coming, and when he comes, he will explain everything to us. Then Jesus declared, I, the one who am speaking to you, I am he. You see, the Samaritan woman, like Jesus, is also tired and thirsty. She is a Samaritan, so she is hated by the Jews. And she is an outsider. Even though she is in Samaria, she is not loved by her people. She's been passed from husband to husband to husband, probably because she is barren. Probably because she cannot have any children of her own. And because of this fact that was not her fault, she is routinely victimized. She's divorced, remarried, and her story is so tragic, and it's so not her fault. She's seen as bad luck. And in this time, 2,000 years ago, she's also seen as property of her husband. And she feels alone. And it seems to me that after all her hurts and trauma, she just prefers it that way. Instead of going to the regular social times to collect water with the other women at dawn and dusk, she heads out in the heat of the middle of the day. I imagine she doesn't need their ridicule and their stares. She doesn't need their questions and their judgment. It's just better at this point. But when she goes to the well, the last thing she expects is to find Jesus asking her to give him a drink. You see, the thing about this woman is that up until this point, her story has been written by other people. She has been defined by her husbands. She has been written off because of her barrenness. And sometimes biblical interpreters today even define her as being a scandalous divorcee who was looking for identity, working her way from one man to another man. But no matter how you look at this text, she is definitely written as an outsider. Her life has been marked by the things that have been done to her, by the rejection she has experienced. And here's the sad, sad thing, is that she believed it. I think the Samaritan woman is a lot like us. Because if we're honest, we believe false things about ourselves all the time. We believe that what has been done to us is who we are. We believe that our struggles and our frustrations are our story. We believe that if we're going to make it out, we have to do it by our own strength and our own ability. We believe that we have to make our own value and our own worth. But friends, what we get to learn from the woman at the well is that Jesus wants to point out what she is missing. And Jesus wants to point out to us today what we are missing. You see, this is so exciting. Jesus has an alternative story to offer her, a different narrative, a total rewrite. He gets her to see the thing that she has been missing the whole time. He gets her to point out the cool moonwalking bear. And let's see what she does with that. After this experience, then she leaves her water jar and she goes back to the town and says to the people, the same people who rejected her, she says to them, come, see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah? And what happens to them? Many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me everything I ever did. And they said to the woman, we no longer believe because of what you said. We have heard for ourselves, and we know that this man really is the Savior of the world. You see, after she sees Jesus, after she has that moment, her story is changed, and she can't unsee it now. And I want you to notice something here that I think is really important. This isn't like a Jesus doesn't say, after you pull your stuff together, then your story can be changed. right? Jesus doesn't say, once you've got your act together, then you can have this living water, then you can have this grace. And Jesus doesn't say to us, once you quit your drinking or forgo your addiction or get your stuff in control or stop being a control freak, then forgiveness is for you. Jesus doesn't say, once you get yourself organized, once you get your house in order or your finances, then this love is for you. No, instead, this love has been there for her the whole time. And this love has been for you the whole time. Because friends, it is easy to miss something that we're not looking for. And she, the Samaritan woman, is so excited about this revelation that she cannot wait to go tell other people about it. And so who does she run to? The same people that just rejected her whole life. The same people that told her story was not enough. The same people that told her that her story didn't matter. The same people who didn't want to walk with her to the well. And what does she do with that? She rewrites their story. She shows them the love and grace that she has received from Jesus, and she passes it on to the very people who rejected and punished her and called her bad luck. You see, this is our story. The Samaritan woman is our story because we let mean girls at lunch tables define us. We let circumstances get the better of us. We get sold what we think will make our story better. We get lost in our own expectations of busyness and of how other people see us, and we take our eyes off of what Jesus has for us, the living water that's right there for us, which is simply just Jesus himself. And we get that, and we understand that, and we can't help but go proclaim this freedom and love to other people, to point out Jesus right there in the mess and muckiness of what it means to be human, what it means to be living this life. But I'll be honest this morning as your preacher. In the mess and muckiness of my life, I struggle. I struggle to see what Jesus is doing in the chaos swirling around me. And sometimes I struggle feeling the presence of God. I let the stress and the overwhelmness and the fatigue of all the other stories trying to make their mark on me leave me thinking that I'm walking alone to the well, hoping that I can find some comfort, some glimpse of God. And I'll have a feeling that God maybe doesn't care about my story or shouldn't bother. And I will feel that I'm really alone or my life's a mess. At one of history's most darkest times, World War II, after one of the concentration camps were liberated, these words were left anonymously etched into one of the walls of the prison barracks. I believe in the sun, even when it's not shining. I believe in love, even when there's no one there. And I believe in God, even when he is silent. It's in those dark times, my friends, where you are never alone. And it is in those dark times when we need Samaritan women. And it's in those dark times when we need people to point out where God is in our midst. It's in those dark times when we need each other to remind us that God is the author of our stories, to hold our hand, to point it out for us. It's in those dark times when we need people to bring us back to the living water of Jesus' love for us. It's in those dark times when we need others to show us what Jesus is doing. And I like what Donovan Riley says, that for years I was like a man with his back to the ocean, staring at a shot glass of water that I thought was God's grace. And then I turned and I saw. You see, this living water that we often miss has the total ability to change us, to transform and rewrite our stories, to help you see that you are loved and that you have always been loved. And when you thought you were alone, you weren't. God's stories are written by God's love for us. And our stories are changed by seeing what grace God has poured down on us through the love of his son, Jesus Christ. Look, it's right there for you. And why? Because your story, each and every one of your stories, absolutely matters to God. Please pray with me. Lord Jesus, we thank you for being the author and protector of our stories. Help us to see the parts in which you are present, those tough parts, those struggles, and that loneliness. Help us to bring others into the grace that you continually provide. Give us eyes to see that you are there for us and that your love shines bright through all things. In your merciful, gracious name, amen.